Over the radio, the SEALs reported Bin Laden was dead. The news of Bin Laden's death brought celebrations to the streets of the United States. But it also haunted the world with memories of a clear September morning a decade before, when the streets of America were choked by terror.
That mystique and that legacy goes way, way back to even Vietnam and before, you know. The enemy knew the men in green faces. If they were coming for you, you weren't coming back.
Since World War II, SEALs and their forefathers have faced whatever threat the enemies of each generation have posed. From Hitler's beaches to Bin Laden's terror. While the perils have changed and will continue to, the invisible men behind the face masks still claim a common heritage and future. No matter how sophisticated they or their foes become, they are simply frogmen.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a very special guest on with me today, former Navy SEAL Remy Adeleke. Right, Remy, what's up, brother?
What's up, my man? What's up, my man? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. It's been a while. We were trying to get something going. So I'm glad to finally be able to talk to you.
Yeah. It's been like 2 years we've been trying to do this.
So, you know, we'll kind of walk through a bit of your career and what you were doing prior to joining the Navy and that's a big part of your story and it's a part of who you are.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you also have a book coming out as well. Can we talk about that quickly?
My book is dropping May 14th. So if you listen to this now, my book's dropped today. If it's May 14th, it drops May 14th. It's called Transform, a Navy SEAL's unlikely journey from the throne of Africa to the streets of the Bronx to defying all odds. And, it's my journey, man. I talk a lot about my failures in life, and I'm sure we'll cover my story in the podcast, but it's a motivational book, man. It's a book to inspire people to reach for goals, and dreams that they think that they can never reach for. So I'm excited about it hitting the shelves.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's good for people because there's inspiration and motivation out there, you know.
Yeah.
But I think people need to sometimes hear that or see that because maybe there's a kid in the Bronx, you know, in a bad situation and he feels like he has no options kind of thing.
No, absolutely.
Then, you know, and then they'll see your story and go, hey, maybe I can do something. Or maybe if it's not become a Navy SEAL, maybe it's just push yourself that hard.
Exactly.
And whatever
and
it is.
That's why I wrote the book. You know, I mean, I know you've had other guys from the Special Forces community on this podcast. And it's like a big taboo to be a SEAL, especially, but to be in any branch of special operations and to write a book. Like, literally, like if you write a book and you're a SEAL, like you could be ostracized. And for a long period of time, people were telling me, man, Remy, like your story is just crazy, inspirational. And I know we're going to cover it here, but, you know, like coming from Africa and the Bronx and this and that, and being a SEAL, like you need to write a book. And I was like, nah. And it wasn't until I went on Kathy Lee Gifford's show, the Today Show, like back in 2017, you know, I shared a little bit of my story. And she was like, your book needs to be made and then your book needs to be turned into a movie. And I was like, nah. And she took me backstage afterwards and she was like, you need to do this. And I said, no. And she said, why not? I said, well, in our community, you know, you can be ostracized. And she said, well, I know your heart. Your heart is to write it for those kids who are like you. And I was like, absolutely. So she said, go write it. So the main reason was for what you just said, you know, is to inspire that kid, man, in Marble Hill, you know, inspire that kid on Fordham or Sedgwick, you know, Compton, Gun Hill Road, wherever. Man, like, I could be something great, you know? I could be a SEAL. I could be a doctor. I could be a lawyer. Like, I don't have to just be, like, a rapper or, you know, a drug dealer or athlete, you know, not knocking that, but just saying, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think it's important because, you know, you and me are actually from the same
part of New York.
You know,
like from where I grew up and where you grew up is probably 20 minutes apart, or if that.
Yeah.
Me myself, I was kind of a knucklehead growing up, so I understand what that life is like, and then I also understand that that's not what you should be doing, and then there are better things and better options for you out there. And
absolutely.
So were you born in Africa and then came to the U.S.?
Yeah. So I was born in Western Africa. I lived in Nigeria. My dad, he was a well-known Nigerian engineer. As a matter of fact, he engineered one of the first man-made islands in the world that exists to this day, and it's called Banana Island. And because of my dad's success as an engineer, entrepreneur, philanthropist, we were rich. So, like, I wasn't born. You know, a lot of people think, oh, your story started out with you not having anything. I was born into a rich family. Like, we had nannies, we had drivers, we had cars, we traveled all over the world. We didn't live in a house. We lived on a compound. I mean, we had it all. But Nigeria is very, very corrupt, and it's still corrupt to this day, and it was very corrupt at the time. And because of corruption, the Nigerian government, they essentially stripped our family of everything. Like, my dad had invested millions and millions of dollars in the Banana Island, which was his most prized asset, and the Nigerian government stripped it from him. And, like, literally, like, within days, and I'm not even exaggerating, within days of fighting the Nigerian government for the land back, like, he died, like, mysteriously. And so when he died, we went from rich, like having everything, to poor, like literally, like when I say poor, I mean, my mom didn't have like a nickel in her account, like wow. She had nothing. And so my mom, she grew up in New York. I tell people all the time, my mom's story is like the real coming to America story, because with Eddie Murphy, because she met my dad, and it's literally a real story, because I heard my dad met at the Metropolitan Museum.
Wow.
And he was like, yeah, I'm a Nigerian prince, and you know, I'm rich, and I'm this and that. And my mom was like, whatever. and because she's a New Yorker, so she was like, nah, whatever. But it ended up all being true. You know, my dad was a Nigerian chief. Which, you know, in English culture, we refer to royalty as king, queen, prince. But my dad was a chief. And then our last name, Adeleke, Ade means crown, and Leke means is above. So it was all reality. So, you know, after my mom and dad met, my mom moved in Africa. And she was kind of thrust into this world of royalty. So, So after my dad died, my mom was just like, there's no way I'm raising these kids
in Africa. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So she moved us back to the States permanently, and I grew up in the Bronx, man. That's where my journey in the Bronx started.
So how old were you when you came to the Bronx?
I was five.
Okay. So pretty much most of your memories are of the Bronx.
Yeah, man. It's just, you know, fire hydrants and running through, you know what I mean?
Yeah, summertime. You know,
going to the bodegas and, you know, still the 25-cent, you know, bag of chips, and now and later is 5-cent fishies and all that. And, you know, cracking, you know, we used to call it snapping, you know, snapping on your boys, you know what I mean? And just, I think the term now is roasting, like you roast somebody, and like all that, man, playing two-hand touch football. Like all my memories are from the Bronx, growing up in the Bronx. Like I have limited memories from being in Africa. And that's why when I wrote the book, I had to do tons of research and interview my mom and you know, interview people who were close to my dad so that I could be as accurate as possible. But a lot of my main memories was from, you know, Fordham and Sedgwick, man. Fordham Road, man.
Yeah, Fordham Road, man. That's one of the most traffic-filled streets in New York, man.
Yeah.
You're driving, stay off of Fordham.
I know, man, especially in the summertime, man, because everybody out in the summertime, man.
So then, you know, you guys come to the Bronx, and, you know, now you're living in the Bronx and you're growing up. So what was that like for you once you're like old enough to, you're out on your own in some ways and going to school? How was that a whole experience for you?
It was, you know, it was... Man, I mean, growing up in New York, it was a lot. Now, as far as like the transition early on, I didn't really notice it too much because my mom, she did a great job at trying to show, trying to show my brother and I that our life was as normal as it could be. You know what I mean? Like, my mom struggled a lot financially. I remember there were times she would take us to the, you know, maintenance office in our building and ask for, you know, an extra few days to pay the rent. You know, there were times when my mom didn't have enough food to feed herself. She had just enough food to feed my brother and I. She was split up between us, you know. So it was hard. Me and my brother shared clothes and sneakers and socks and, you know, yeah. It was, you know, that. So I remember all that. But yeah, I love growing up in the Bronx because I gained so many lessons, you know, especially from, you know, from the streets, man, just like how to trust people, when to trust people, you know, how when to keep your mouth shut. You know what I'm saying? You can't just be bumping your gums everywhere because you're going to end up getting knocked out, man. I grew up, you know, I was jumped, you know, and I've seen people jumped. I saw that. I grew up fighting, like a lot of fights. DeVoe basketball court. I don't know. Like, I got in fights on the DeVoe basketball court many a times and got jumped on DeVoe basketball court a time. So it was a crazy dynamic living in the Bronx and growing up there. But, you know, it really gave me lessons and tools that are still with me to this day. Yeah. But, you know, I, and you can relate to this because how old are you now?
31.
Yeah. So we about the same age. I'm 36. But, you know, in the late 80s and the early 90s, like hip hop music and hip hop culture was like, it was the thing. You know what I mean? It was like, it was blown up. We had like Jay and Biggie and Nas and, you know, and you know, Outkast and Tupac and just Busta Rhymes and just all of these rappers and all of these artists. And, you know, I didn't have a father growing up, you know, because, you know, he died, obviously. But I was always looking for a father to teach me how to be a man, right. You know, like unconsciously, like I would say consciously, 20%, but unconsciously, like 80%.
Right.
And so, you know, I would listen to hip hop music and the culture and, you know, all that. And that's what kind of molded me. You know what I mean? So, you know, I heard rappers talk about selling drugs. So that's what I want. That's what I thought I needed to do. Cause you know, they look like me and they came from the inner city like me. You know, I heard rappers talking about hooking up with multiple girls. Cause that's the thing to do. And so that's what I did. I heard talking about punching people in the face who disrespect you. So that's what I did. You know what I mean? And so, you know, how I learned how to become a man was through hip hop and hip hop culture, street culture, you know, being out in the streets. And so, you know, I went through high school, and in high school, all my friends called me Sean John. Like, that was my nickname in high school because that's when the Sean John gear came out. And I was hustling. I was making so much money hustling. I had so many scams in my time. I had like this sneaker scam, dude, where I was, you know, I worked at Athlete's Foot. Right. I don't know. That was the name of the sneaker shop, Athlete's Foot. And like I remember customers would come in and instead of like ringing them up at the register, I would, you know, I'd be like, yo, just give me the cash. And, you know, like, so if the sneakers were like $80, I'd be like, yo, just give me $50 cash. And so I had this huge racket going. And in high school, I was a man. Like, everybody came to me for sneakers. You know what I'm saying? I can get the Jordans. I can get everything, you know.
Right.
And so I was like the hustle dude. So in high school, everybody called me Sean John because, you know, when I got that money, I was buying nothing but Sean John clothes, man. I had the hats, you know, the bubble jacket, all that. and then, you know, as time passed, you know, that's when I really got into selling drugs heavier, you know, and then from there, I got to like high level scams where I was running illegal cell phone scams, bringing in thousands and thousands of dollars a week. And the reason why I was doing all that was because I was trying to get into the music game. You know, like I wanted to have my own record company. As a matter of fact, I started a record company. It was called Eighth Wonder Entertainment. It was called Eighth Wonder Entertainment at the time. Me and my boys and, you know, kind of got some artists from high school I grew up with and all that. And you know, I was funneling all my money, my drug money, cell phone money into the record company. And, you know, we even put an album together. So we were doing pretty well. But, you know, everything came crashing down like in 2001, like 3 months after 9/11, I got involved in a deal with a drug dealer. Went bad. I sold him like a bunch of products. Like, this dude's Jamaican cattle for Gun Hill Road, actually, you know. And I sold him like a bunch of product that was supposed to last for a certain amount of time, and it only lasted for a fraction of that time. And the mistake I made, you know, and this is something I learned as far as being in the Bronx, is about trusting people. Like, I had given this dude trust instead of, you know, allowing him to earn his trust. And I remember, like, when I would meet with him. Like, he lived in the projects off of Gun Hill Road. He would never bring me, like, he would never bring me into his building. He would never even bring me to the project. So I didn't know where he lived. But every time he came to meet me, I would bring him in my apartment, you know, which rookie move.
Right.
And so when things went south on what I sold him, he came knocking on my mom's door. And like, it was just a straight up threat. Like, yo, if you don't have my money, like, things ain't going too well for you. And I knew what that meant, because I knew his reputation in the streets, you know, and I, and like, he's going to kill me, you know what I mean? And so, like, I made him his money in like a day. And then this was December 2001. And then after that, I was just like, I'm done with like this hustling game. Like, I'm done doing this. Like, I need to figure out a different path. And, you know, for 6 months, I did nothing. Like, I literally did nothing for 6 months. And then in June of 2002, that's when I made the decision I was going to join the Navy.
So when you joined the Navy, did you know that you wanted to be a SEAL, or is that something you learned about as you joined?
Nah, it was something, you know, it was back in, and I hate to backtrack, but, you know, back in 95, the movie Bad Boys came out. And when I watched that movie, that kind of inspired me, like, to be something like a SEAL, but I didn't know what, right? And the reason why was because that was the first time I saw two black dudes who were heroes, but they still had swagger. They were still cool. You know what I mean? Like, they weren't like uptight. Like, I hated it. I mean, you could relate to it. I hated the NYPD growing up, right? Yeah. So anything cop related, I hated. But when I saw them, I was like, man, like, I could be something like that and be cool.
Right. And then that's cool. Yeah.
Exactly. That's cool. You know, and they funny, and they still got swagger. And then a year later, The Rock came out. I don't know if you remember that movie. And it's The Rock. With Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I saw Navy SEALs, because it was Navy SEALs in that movie. You know, they were underwater, and they were real SEALs. So Michael Bay, he used real SEALs in that. Because he, you know, that's how I later got into the film and TV industry. And that's later in the story, but, you know, because Michael Bay was looking for an African-American SEAL. And so,
you worked with him, right.
Yeah, that's how I got cast in Transformers. So, you know, flashback to when The Rock came out, when I saw that movie and I saw them dudes in the water with the scuba gear coming out with the suppressed guns and the black suits, I was like, yo, I was like, I want to do that. Like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a SEAL. But, you know, I think I was like 15 at the time. And, you know, so it was like, it wasn't a reality. It was just kind of like me saying right now, I want to be president. And so, you know, I kind of put that dream deep down inside of me. But when I finally went to the Navy recruiter's office that day, you know, flash forward, that's when I was like, I'm joining to be a SEAL. Like, I'm not joining the Navy to be a deck seaman. I'm not joining the Navy to be anything else but a SEAL. And, but there were a few issues. You know, I didn't qualify to be a SEAL in any way. So I couldn't get a SEAL contract. One, I didn't have the ASVAB scores. You got to score really, really high on the ASVAB to even get a chance to go to BUDS. Two, I was super skinny. You know what I mean? And three, I couldn't swim, you know, to be a SEAL. You know, I'm growing up in the Bronx. There wasn't a lot of, like, pools to, be, you know, go swimming. So I didn't have what it take from a swim person. And then the big thing, too, the recruiter, she was from the Bronx. And after she ran my background check, because they got to do a quick background in order to see if you qualify for the Navy, she found out that I had two warrants out for my arrest. I had a warrant in New Jersey and I had a warrant in New York. And so, like, when she told me that, I got up and I got ready to leave. And she was like, where are you going? I was like, I'm leaving because I can't join. She was like, you got a suit. And I was like, nah, I don't have a suit. She was like, do you have, like, a collar shirt and slacks? And I was like, yeah. She said, come back, you know, next week or whatever. She said, you know, come back next week. And so I came back the following week, and she took me to both judges. She took me to the, just drove me like in a government vehicle. She was in her dress uniform. And she took me to a judge in Jersey. Wow. She took me to a judge in New York, and like, she stood in front of them and she like advocated on my behalf. She was like, listen, 9/11 just took place a few months earlier. This guy, yes, he's made mistakes and did some things he wasn't supposed to do, but he's trying to turn his life around by joining the Navy. But I can't let him in the Navy with a record. Like, can you expunge his record? And both judges, like, unanimously said,
wow,
yeah, we'll expunge his record. And then, even with my record expunged, I still wasn't allowed to join the Navy. Because when you go to MEPS, they ask you all these questions, like, have you ever been arrested? Have you ever, like, done this? Have you ever done that? Have you ever had your record sealed or expunged? And if you answer yes to any of those questions, that pretty much disqualifies you. And even if it's an expunge or seal, because the reason why they ask that question is because they need to know what you did. And if your record is expunged or sealed, they don't know what you did. And so you could have raped somebody. And so to them, because we don't know whether you raped somebody, we don't want to bring you into the Navy for you to rape somebody. So because it's sealed or you can't come in. And so, like, but she had fudged all my paperwork. She had got my record cleared so fast that when we went to MEPS, like, nothing showed up in the system. And literally, like, that was the – and, yo, I remember when I wrote that story in my book, I was like, man, this woman had to be an angel. Like,
yeah.
Like, she died 4 years after she did that for me, dude.
Wow.
You know, and she – and the only – and the crazy thing about it is I didn't find out until last year. Because, you know, and I'm kind of jumping around, but, you know, when you're in the Navy and you meet all these people, you forget their names and time passes. And you know, I tried to reach out to her after I got in, but I had lost contact with her. And then, like, I had totally forgot her name. So, you know, after I finished writing a book, I went to go look in my military records to find something. And I found her name and I Googled her name and I found this memorial page and I found out that. And she had died like in 2006 of like this. She was 30 years old. She had died of like this super rare autoimmune disease. But I ended up meeting up with her brother, you know, and her family. As a matter of fact, her brother would be a good dude for you to interview because he was in the Air Force. And he's like a poet now. But man, that dude told me that that's what she would do. He was like, man, she would drive around the Bronx and she would look for cats who were drug dealers. Dudes were getting in trouble, and she would be like, listen, I know where your path is going. I know where your life is going. Come with me so I can help change your life. And she would sneak people into the Navy, man. And so, like, it was a blessing that I met her that day because any other recruiter, if they would have ran my record, I'd have been blacklisted because what would have happened was they would have sort of warrants. They probably would have turned me in. But then on top of that, they would have put me in a database of a person with a record, and I'd have never been able to join the military. So, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how I got in.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did a good job, man. She did a good job. That definitely changed the direction that your life was moving in.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I would probably be dead or in prison if it wasn't for her, man.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, it's we were talking about it a little bit before we got on, but some of the a lot of the things that you learn in the streets aside from the actual criminal part of it.
Yeah.
It those are like life lessons that some people never learn in their life, you know, as far as situational awareness.
Yeah.
Being able to look someone in the eye and see what they're about, you know, those kind of things. And and like we discussed before, and you said a lot of those things really helped you in your career as a SEAL.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, 110%, man. You know, and I kind of, before I even get to the SEAL part, because I know we're going to get there, and I can go into, I'm going to go into even greater detail, but just going to boot camp, man. Like, going to boot camp, man. Like, when it was harder for like, other kids, for me, it was easy. You know, for me, it was like, yeah, I grew up in the Bronx. You know what I mean? Like, this ain't hard for me. And then, you know, go from there, I go to my first command. And when I got to my first command, which was Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton, that's when I really put the pedal to the metal to like train. Like I had to study my ASVAB, you know, I had to get my ASVAB scores high. I had to learn how to swim. I had to learn how to, you know, I had to learn how to work out to put on strength. And what got me through all that was my upbringing, you know, because, you know, as I was saying, if you make it in New York, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that kind of mentality stuck with me where, you know, every day, like I was in pain, it was cold. You know, I didn't feel like training, but I just knew, like, I'm from New York, I'm from the Bronx, like, I need to represent, and I need to make it. And so, I didn't have a car, so I would run 3 miles to the pool, jump in the water, in the shallow end, and then try to teach myself how to swim. And I would run 3 miles back home, you know, and I just had, all my focus was on working at the hospital and training. And within a year of checking into Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton, I was checking out. I checked out in a year and went to SEAL training, you know what I mean, which is... That's another thing that's unheard of, because usually, like, when you go to your first command, you have to wait at least 18 months before you can even start the process to apply to go to SEAL training. And I was already in SEAL training a year after getting to my first command. So I got the buds, and, you know, I made it through first phase, made it through Hell Week, and then I got to second phase. And when I got to second phase, and there's more to the story, I won't kind of bore you with it, I ended up getting kicked out. And it was partly because, you know, my pride, you know, after I made it through Hell Week, in my mind, you know, I was like that Kanye West song. It's like, you can't tell me nothing, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like, I made it from Africa. I made it through the Bronx. I'm almost done with SEAL. I made it through the hardest part of SEAL training. I'm about to be a SEAL. Yo, nobody can't tell me nothing. And so, you know, that's how I felt, you know? And so instead of like working on what I needed to work on the weekends, I was at the clubs, man. I was at the clubs hooking up with girls, man. I remember being at the clubs and girls would be like, so what do you do? And I was like, I'm a Navy SEAL, man. And I was at buzz, man. You know what I'm saying? Like lying to girls just to hook up with them. And, you know, and I was just reckless, man. And so anyway, that ended up like really coming back on me because, you know, I ended up like failing some tests in second phase, die phase. And I went to an academic review board and they were like, you know, remember, we see you got what it takes, you know, to be a SEAL because you made it through Hell Week and you're almost there. But, you know, you failed some of your swims and you failed like, you know, your dive test. So we got to kick you out. So they kicked me out of SEAL training. And when they kicked me out of SEAL training, I had to go. I went back to Camp Pendleton. But this time I was stationed in the infantry as a Navy corpsman because I was a corpsman. And I tell you something, man, it was a huge humbling. It was a humbling that I needed. I needed really bad. And the day after I got kicked out of SEAL training, man, like literally, like I was in a pool, man. I was like working on everything that I needed to work on to get back. I didn't know if I was going to be able to get back because, you know, at that time, like with infantry, a lot of infantry cats were getting killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Or if not killed, they were getting like permanently injured. Like it was this one dude I was in buzz with. He had got performance drop as well. And he went to 1st Marine Division and he was in and it's a crazy story because I was supposed to be where he was, but I had gotten there a little bit later and he was in a convoy in Iraq and hit an IED. Wow. Everybody in his vehicle died except for him. But he was permanently like crippled, like permanent brain damage, everything. It's just all. And I remember seeing that dude in the hospital, you know, like a year later and you know, he's all messed up, man. Like scars all over. Like he barely hold a conversation. Like from what I remember, he couldn't talk. But anyway, there was no guarantee I was gonna be able to get back to SEAL training. But you know, I didn't let that kind of keep me from doing what I needed to do. So like every day I was training, doing what I needed to do to get back. And 2 years later, I went back. And after I went back, I made it through SEAL training. And that's when the real fun began. You know, where I was able to actually like put all that training and all the lessons I learned throughout my career and throughout my life, you know, in a practice as an operator.
What team did you go to?
So I was on SEAL Team 3. That was my first team. Great team. I was in the Punisher platoon, Delta platoon. it was great, man. It was great, man. I got a chance to, you know, do some awesome things, man, in my career, man. And, you know, direct action, kicking down doors, sneaking to dudes' houses. As a matter of fact, I love that because as a kid, I always hated bullies. Especially like growing up in the Bronx, you know, and being bullied and being jumped and all that. So you know, those dudes, you know, and I'm just being real generic, just for the sake of confidentiality. But you know, a lot of the dudes that I went after, they were just big bullies. So what I loved about my job was, you know, being able to, you know, be that dude that's like knocking on their door, you know, proverbially and literally, and you know, snatching them up, you know, doing what needs to be done, you know, to make sure that they don't hurt people anymore. So, you know, I got a chance to do DAs, reconnaissance missions, like, you know, intel, like all kinds of stuff. And as a matter of fact, you know, we talked about behind this conversation before we jumped on, you know, my specialty was intelligence collection. And in the military, that's called HUMINT. So HUMINT stands for human intelligence. And in order to get into the human intelligence program, you got to go through a real hard mental test. And I can't really go into detail about it, but I'll just call it like a mental test where you got to just do a lot of crazy things in a room. Like it's nothing physically, it's in a room and you're getting graded by these three other human operators. And I passed the entry exam to get into the program. And then from there, I went to school. I had to go to a specific human school. I can't talk about the name of it. And after I graduated from that school, that gave me the qualification to essentially be an intelligence collector. So to run, you know, and I'm gonna just say informants just for the sake of, you know, keeping it clean, but, you know, run informants and just collect information that was gonna lead to direct action missions. So I would meet with people. I would carry tons of money on me. And you know, and being grown up in the Bronx, you know, it was easy for me identifying when people were, you know, playing me, trying to play me, trying to just get money from me. People were, when people were telling the truth, or when people were double agent working for a terrorist organization. So all of the things that I had learned in the streets, like, it prepared me. And I didn't even know that it was preparing me all those years, but that prepared me to do that job, you know. And we were going to do a lot of cool operations, you know, based off of intel that I collected and do some other stuff. So yeah, I had a great career in the teams, man.
Yeah, that kind of thing, you know, they call it like street smarts, that kind of thing. A lot of that, like anyone, like if you look at history and you look at the history of, you know, the intelligence agencies and, I mean, going way back, like to, you know, World War One, World War Two, a lot of the things that were required, obviously they want smart people to do these kind of things, but you need to have the ability to interact with people to gain people's trust, you know, to exactly. All these kind of things, these human interactions you need to be good at. Yeah. And people are the same all over the world. Maybe the circumstances may be different.
Yeah.
But everyone's the same. I mean, like anywhere I've been in the world, you know, I connect with people and we learn, you know, you learn things about the cultures and whatnot. And just having that street smarts,
yeah,
I feel like helps me move through certain places that people absolutely just can't do it, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the cool thing, too, was like I would recognize when cats who did do my job, but didn't come from where I came from, like I would be able to observe as they did the job, and an informant wasn't responding, you know what I mean? And so, and I kind of throw out this example. So, one thing that I had learned, like in one particular country I was in, I had learned that the people loved like black comedians, like literally, like they loved black comedians, like Martin Lawrence, Eddie Murphy, like all of these cats, like Bernie Mac, and they knew all about them. They could tell you, they couldn't speak a lick of English, but through an interpreter, they could tell you everything about these cats, right? And their movies. And so like when I recognize that, you know, from a street perspective, when you see leverage or you see a common ground, like you learn from the streets how to use that, how to leverage that, or not manipulate that, but how to use that for your benefit. And so I would act like Martin Lawrence when I would go into meetings with this cat, with these cats, like literally. And the dudes who did my job, you know, majority of them were white dudes. They would look at me like I was stupid because they didn't get it. But I would walk into the meeting. I'd be like, "Yo, what's up? What's up? What's up, man? Like, what's the deal? Like, yo, what's up, nigga? What's up with your clothes, man? What's going on?" And they couldn't understand what I was saying because they weren't Americans. They couldn't understand verbally. I was talking to them, but they would just be laughing.
Right, because they recognize the body language. Because, right,
exactly. They recognize the body language. They recognize the high pitch, everything. You know what I mean? And they would just start laughing. They would go to the interpreter. And they would say, they'd be like, "Man, this guy's funny. This guy's funny." And then I would continue on. And they'd be like, "Man, I like this guy. I like this guy." And I could, and then I want to ask them for any information. I would just continue to be like, you know, joke around, but at the same time be serious. You know, like learn when to pull back. You know, not be extra and do too much. And then, you know, by like halfway through the meeting, they would be like, "Yo, so-and-so, you know, terrorist, Bouja, whatever, like, you need me to tell you where he's at or where he's going to be, or you want me to tell you what happened the other day, this and that." And there were times where I'd be like, nah, I'm just trying to kick it with you. Like, you know, I'd be like, "I just want to kick it with you." You know what I'm saying? Like, we can talk about that later. And then, like, and the reason why I didn't want to, like, because I didn't want them to think that I just had them there for just that reason. And then as time passed, eventually I'd be like, "Yo, I'll take you up on that offer." And that's how I collected mad information. Like, I collected so much information just doing that. And again, I learned all of that from the streets, observing your target. And I'm going to use that term really loosely, like observing your target, or even if it's a chick, right? You see a girl and you're like, "Man, she's fine." Like, a smart dude is not going to, and you know, I learned this in the streets. A smart dude is not going to just beeline to her and just start spitting game.
Right. Never works.
Most dudes that do that, they get turned down real quick.
Yeah.
Especially in New York, girl. You know what
I'm saying? You got to be a pro, man.
Yeah, a New York girl's going to embarrass you. She's going to embarrass you in front of everybody, right? But the smart cats, you sit back and you observe. And you're like, okay. You see how she moves. You see, you know, what she likes. Like, you sit back and you take notes. And then when the time is right, then you slide in and say what needs to be said the way it needs to be said. And I learned that from growing up in New York, and that's how I applied it to what I did in my job. And, you know, that's how, you know, I had a great career doing what I did, man. I was in the team for 7 years, man. So it was great, man.
And how long were you in? Oh, so you were in the team, you said, for 7 years, the teams?
Yep, 7 years. Six years was really like, it was 8 years, but I just say seven because, you know, seven and a half, you know, sometimes when you say, seven and a half, people are like, oh, you'd be an extra. But you say eight, then that's not honest. So I always go down to seven just to keep it close.
But that's like the street smarts again coming in. You know, you're playing a
exactly. So cats will pull your card. You know, you say 8 years, they're gonna be like, oh nah, you wasn't 8 years. You say seven and a half, and you'd be an extra. Seven, you say, you know what I'm saying? But yeah, there's 7 years, you know, and overall 13 years, and I had an awesome career, man. I traveled all most of, you know, three deployments to the Middle East, you know what I mean? Different parts, you know, doing a lot of cool stuff. There were times that I would pinch myself and just be like, man, how did I get here? You know, because I worked with three letter agencies, and that's a whole nother thing, you know, that, you know, I can't really go into great detail, but I've done work with the CIA. I've done work with DIA. I've done work with, you know, other three-letter agencies. And there were times when I was like, man, like I'm a kid from the Bronx, man. You know what I mean? And in a majority of the rooms that I was in, I was the only minority.
Right.
You know, I was the only minority. I'm in these high-level rooms. So it was awesome, man. And that's why I tell young cats all the time. And I work with, I do a lot of nonprofit inner city work here in California. Okay. You know, because, you know, my thing is, you know, I was blessed by my recruiter and other people in my life who came into my life to help me get to where I'm at. And so I'm just like, man, I need to get back. So I got kids, man, like young inner city kids in the hoods of different parts of Southern California. And they're my projects. And one thing I try to encourage them to do is like military, man, like join the military. If you don't know what you're going to do, let's at least go to a recruiter and talk about it. You know, and if there's interest in military, let's talk about, you know, special forces. Or going to the academy and becoming an officer, or going through OCS and becoming a medical officer. So it's something that I really tried to encourage, you know, the kids that I mentor in with City of Hope. City of Hope, LA, it's called the Mesa City of Hope. That's a nonprofit that I work with.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. You know, it's interesting. A friend of mine, he was a squadron commander at Delta Force.
Yeah.
And now he's part of an organization called the Green Beret Project. And they basically target inner city youth, minority kids, you know. So, So it's all, and they, you know, they work like in different states, and they use kind of that special forces method, you know, from the ground up and, you know, the unconventional thing. And I don't know if you were aware, I think it was last summer. There was a kid who was killed in the Bronx, a Dominican kid. Do you remember that? He was stabbed to death.
Yeah. There was a because his funeral was on TV.
Yeah, yeah.
I watched it from here. I watched part of it. Yeah, that was sad because they were trying to kill somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a mistaken identity type deal, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the whole thing was caught because they stabbed him right outside of a bodega and there were cameras. So the whole thing was on camera, and that's what really made it, you know, gruesome and upsetting for people. And he was like a nice young kid, and you know, he wasn't involved in any kind of street thing, but he was just wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
And you know, it's really looking at the whole situation as far as inner city minority kids. You know, the rapper Nipsey Hussle was killed recently. I knew his name. I probably heard a song or two, but I didn't know too much about him. But after he died, I kind of looked at him a little bit. And it seemed like he had done a lot for his community and was kind of turning it around. You know, he was a gang member, but he was trying to steer kids away from that and do some important things. But he said something in an interview that really kind of I thought would be good for kids in that situation to hear. And he was talking about how, you know, you have beef with somebody from another gang, and you know, they shot up your neighborhood, so you're going to their neighborhood and you're going to shoot up their neighborhood in retaliation. He's like, but then you when you're driving there, you're driving past, you know, a white guy, a Latino guy, or yeah. Asian.
Yeah.
You're ignoring them. You're driving past a black guy who's dressed nicely and looks like he's educated and he's doing something good with himself. And you're looking for the guy who looks exactly like you.
Exactly. That's real right there.
He's dressed like you. He talks like you. He walks like you. And you're going to kill that guy.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, that's heavy. Because it's like you're killing yourself.
Yeah. And that's exactly what's happening. That's exactly what's happening. And in a lot of these neighborhoods, the kids just don't see any other option, you know?
I know, and it's, and again, it's going back to the reason why I wrote my book and the reason why I'm making myself more public, because man, I feel like I have a responsibility to kind of you know, change the trend. You know what I mean? Because who else are they're getting a lot of this from the people they look up to, and most of the people they look up to, as you know, are the rappers.
Yeah.
And 99% of the rappers ain't living what they rapping.
Right.
So when you look at it, everything is a cycle of falsehoods. You know, I watch this dude who talks about killing people or shooting people or selling drugs, and he's not doing it, because if he was doing it, he would be sitting in a box somewhere. But because I'm watching him do it now, I'm going to do it. And now I do it, and I end up where he would end up if he was really doing it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so it really is sad, man. That whole Nipsey Hussle thing really messed me up, because like you, I didn't know much about him, you know, because, you know, I don't listen to past, like, I'm going to say like 9 years. I haven't, no, 10 years. I haven't listened to hardcore rap. You know, I kind of, you know, as I got older, I kind of like, you know, it was like, you know, I don't want to put that in my mind, in my spirit.
Right.
So I didn't know much about Nipsey Hussle. But man, when I heard his story, man, and the fact that he was giving back, you know what I'm saying? Like, he was actually like in the hood, providing jobs, like providing programs, giving back. And this dude kills him for what? Because he said leave.
Right.
Man, that was crazy, man.
Yeah.
But it happens every day, though. That's the thing. His situation was just public knowledge because of who he was.
Right.
How many times every day in hoods around the country does that happen?
Right. Every day. Every day. Yeah.
All day. You know, so it's crazy, man. I think about Khalif Browder, man.
That was crazy. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, dude grew up right down the street from me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And man, like, think about his situation with the police and getting caught up in the justice system.
Right, and he was in like solitary confinement, and he didn't do anything. He was like in there falsely imprisoned. Is that him?
Yeah, he was falsely imprisoned. He was in solitary confinement for like, and I don't quote me on this, but it was like for like 300 days, something ridiculous.
Yeah, something hard. Yeah, yeah.
And when you look at the science behind solitary confinement, like, I think like a human being is not supposed to be in like solitary confinement for like more than like 2-3 days, because it messes with you psychologically.
Right. And unless you're like part of the small spectrum of human beings who are like, you know, on something else. But the majority of people would just get destroyed by that kind of thing. Absolutely. Exactly. And that's why they do it. It's meant to destroy you, you know, break you or whatever.
Yeah. And he was a kid when he was in there.
Right.
So that thing breaks men.
Yeah,
and all for a book bag, man. You know what I mean? Like, and you know, going back, I hate that I keep going back to my book, but I talk about all of these things in my book, man. I can talk about the justice system, you know, like, you know, because it's not a fair justice system. You know, when you look at my situation, if it wasn't for Tiana, I would probably still be caught up in the justice system, because the government said you are not qualified to take this job because of the mistakes you made before.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And now, if she didn't do what she did, who knows where I would be? I would probably just be in that cycle.
Right.
But because she did what she did, she broke that cycle. So, you know, I talk about that. You know, I talk about the importance of second chances. You know what I mean? There are a lot of kids who make mistakes and they just need a second chance. You know, I talk about the education system in inner cities, man. And a lot of the education systems, a lot of the schools, you know this as well as I do, they're not set up to prepare young kids to go off and be success, go to college and go and they have a career. They literally, a lot of these schools are just preparing them to go into the justice system.
Yep. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, especially in the Bronx during the, those days, schools were just like, the high schools were just like places where, you know, kid, that was like the pre-street life. And then, you know, you went to school, it was just kind of a social thing. It wasn't even about school. It was about hanging out or whatever, you know, and
The teachers didn't care.
Yep.
Teachers would just sit there. Dude, my mom, my brother, dude, I'll tell you this story. Sorry for going off on tangent. My brother, he's like, dude was a genius. Like, he was a total opposite of me. Like, I was out in the streets, but he had like a, one of them, you know, change of heart, coming to Jesus moments when he was like 13. He failed a class, like, or two classes or something like that. And when he came home, you know, he had came home on a day where my mom was just broken, you know, because she was struggling and she didn't know how she was going to make it. And she was just, it was just a bad day for her. And when he showed my mom the report card, she just broke down crying. She was like, it wasn't even like I'm a spank. It was just like, she was just like crying because she was like, I don't know how I'm going to make it. And you failed this class. What am I going to do? Like, bio, I need you to do well. And she, like, she was bawling. And that, in that moment, like, my brother, like, something switch went turned in his brain. And he was like, I'm going to be a genius. literally, he became a genius, dude. So while I was out, you know, running around, he was in the library. Like, he would just go to the library just to read, like, on it. I'm talking, like, 13, 14, 15, 16. You know, like, growing, our friends would call us Pinky in the Brain, you know. I'm serious, because they used to call me Pinky and call him the Brain because my brother was brilliant. Like, so smart that when he was at Kennedy, he graduated like in 3 years. Oh, so he finished everything that he needed to finish to graduate in 3 years. And that fourth year, like, he just took all AP classes. He was like, I'm not going to go to college just yet. I'm going to just do all AP classes so I can get these credits for free, right? Tell me why, and go into the justice system. And on top of that, my brother got a full ride scholarship to study engineering at Syracuse University. Well, in his last semester, in his last semester of his junior year, when he was done with all the classes he needed to finish, the counselor brought him in, and the counselor was like, what do you want to do? Bio was like, I want to go to college. Like, I want to go to college. That's my goal. And he was like, I don't think you should go to college. He's like, I think you should go to a trade school. You should go to a trade school because a trade school is going to be better for you. Like, you probably won't make it in college. Mm. This is what he says to my brother. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And for a counselor in a high school to say that to a kid who you're supposed to be like, no, go to college. Like, you're brilliant. You straight A's, 4.0. Next year's all, it's going to be all, you know, AP classes. Come on, that just shows you how jacked up the system is. And we could argue, oh, well, that's just one teacher. But how many other kids did that one teacher say that to? And how many other teachers or counselors allowed that to be said and not say anything? You know what I'm saying? And my mom said something. My mom went to the school and flipped out on the counselor. It was just like, how dare you do that to my son? How dare you try to derail his future? And my brother ended up going to college, graduated college in 3 years, and he got his master's in 1 year. Dude's making like hundreds of thousands of dollars a year now as a computer science engineer from the Bronx. Wow. So.
Yeah, it's funny too, because I followed this cop. He was a cop in LA, and he worked in South Central. And he, like, just on Instagram, and he would post stuff, you know, I was like, here and there, whatever.
Yeah.
And then he had this post showing Nipsey Hussle in front of a police car with his middle finger pointing towards the, like, the center of the door has, I guess, like, the LAPD's logo and sign and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he basically had this kind of long-winded post, and he was saying something to the effect of, don't make this guy like a martyr. You know, he was a, you know, part of a really bad street gang in Los Angeles, and and responsible for all these bad things happening. And then at the end, he puts, yeah, but, you know, he did do some good things for the community, so I'll give him that. But I thought just the flavor of it was kind of ugly, especially being someone who works in that community. As he said, like, more specifically where he worked, I'm not going to repeat it, but... And then I commented, like, I just don't think this is, like, a cool thing to post, especially given that he was just murdered, you know?
Yeah.
You know, what if his family sees it? What if his wife
sees
it? You know what I mean?
Exactly, yeah, it's just tasteless.
Yeah, and then, so then a bunch of people commented, and, like, two or three dudes are like, yo, I listen to your podcast, I love your podcast, but, like, and I thought you were smart, you know, things like that, you know, and I can't believe your writing this. And I'm just like... You know, I don't understand, and especially some of the, and one of the guys, he was like somewhere from the South, and he had like all this Jesus Christ stuff all over his profile. It's like, you know, what do you know about the Last Supper? You know, Jesus Christ, he ate with prostitutes and thieves and murder. You know what I mean? Like,
Exactly.
And then just like I said, I'm not like a huge Nipsey Hussle fan or anything like that, but just looking at, you know, after he was killed, just kind of looking to his life, you know, he invested for STEM programs, you know, math, science, technology, you know, put his own money. He didn't have to do that. Most guys who make it out of South Central, they move, you know, somewhere in LA, get a nice house and get away from there. But he didn't have to do that, but he did. So to me, just to focus on the early years, like, yes, if someone did bad things and, you know, maybe they should go to prison for it. I mean, like, you know, depending on what they did. Right, you know, I don't want killers in the street, or you know, that kind of thing. But I think when someone is trying to turn it around, and they are turning it around, they're having a positive effect. We shouldn't just try and drag them down. You know that.
I agree.
I agree 100%. Right, he was the day after he was killed. He was set to meet with the
police,
chief of police. Yeah,
they talk about how to reduce gang violence.
Right, how can we scale it down? Right, and so. That showed that he was reaching towards the LAPD and saying, hey, I want to work with you and figure this thing out. And I think it was the chief of police. I think he said it at the press conference or something like that, or he tweeted it. And what he said was, when I heard that it was Nipsey Hussle, I thought, oh, my God, like he was one of the good guys, or he was making a difference.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at some of these communities, the best way to fix them, and this is kind of, I did a podcast with the guy I told you about before. He was a squadron commander at Delta.
Yeah.
And we talked about the way that you fix it. It's like the police aren't going to fix the problem in South Central or in some of these areas. It's that same kind of unconventional warfare mindset from the ground up that fixes it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, when you're, for example, you know, you're overseas and you're working, and, you know, you're in a certain area, it's a bad area, and you need to get into that area, you're going to go to the guy who's been around, maybe he's
the influence. You're going to go to the sheikh. You're going to go to the tribal leader.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? You're going to empower them, you know what I'm saying? And you're not going to do the work for them.
Exactly. You know? And that's how the change comes. You have to influence, and the change has to come organically.
Exactly.
When I look at Nipsey Hussle... what he was, what he was, and what he was kind of transforming into, that was the organic change.
Absolutely.
So as Americans, as human beings, we should want more Nipsey Hussles.
I agree.
Because that's where the change is, or yourself. You know what I'm saying? Like you came from, you know, we come from the same area in New York. So like, you know, we understand these things, and it's like, that's where the change happens organically.
Because most people, they only connect with people they could relate to.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So Nipsey had influence over all of these people from his area. Why? Because all of these people from his area could relate to him.
Right.
You know, it was like they were on the same level. They came from the same world. You know, and that's why I truly feel like it's important for me and Nipsey and other people who come from these worlds to go back. Because like I was sitting with three kids, what's today, Tuesday, at this elementary school. They all three of them in sixth grade. They the three baddest kids in the school. Like the three, I mean, the teachers can't control them. They get suspended. I mean, they do stuff. I mean, like the principal don't know what to do with them. You know what I mean? They can't sit down for like 3 minutes without like running wild. I sat down with them for like 45 minutes. Why was that? Because I was able to look them in the eye and say, listen, I come from where you come from. And not just look them in the eye and say something, but they could feel that this guy knows me. I'm him. And it's that relatable factor. And so we need people, like you said, most cops, the police don't police in the areas they come from.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like right. most politicians, pretty much all politicians that lead a district, or let's just kind of keep district out, but let's just say a state, you know, congressional politicians, they don't live in the worst or the poorest district in their state. You know what I'm saying? So it's just one of those things where because you can't relate and I can't relate to you, one, because you can't relate to me, you're not going to know how or where I need the best help.
Right. What's making me tick? And
exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I keep referring back to this guy who was a commander at the unit. And one of the things we were talking about off the podcast was, you know, they're going into inner cities mainly.
Yeah.
And he was thinking about maybe trying to set up in New York. And I'm like, look, if you want to set up in New York, I could probably help you because I could go into the South Bronx.
Yeah.
And I could go into these schools. You know what I mean? I can help you
get set up. And I'm going to come with you.
Yeah. And so he's like, and then, but it's just so funny, or not funny, but it's interesting. Like he's totally aware of that. And he's saying like, yeah, like, you know, this was actually right around the time that the murder happened in the Bronx with that kid. And he was saying like, look, he's like, I could go to the Bronx, like physically I can go there, but he's like, they're not going to connect to a bunch of white boys, you know, who were in special forces.
Yeah.
He's like, so we need that organic, you know, organic to that area. And we need to be able to set up that way. And that's just, I feel like the people who were only focusing on like the negative for Nipsey,
mm-hmm.
I feel like they're not thinking on that level. And actually a good friend of mine, he's Mexican American. He might be from South Central or from Texas. I forget. I podcasted with him before, but he was a Green Beret for 20 years, you know, 8, 9, 10 deployments, something like that. And he had a post about Nipsey and he's like, look, like I come from the streets and this guy comes from the streets and I completely turned my life around. And, you know, it's a tragic loss. And the reason why I brought up Nipsey is because I wanted to address, you know, some of those comments. People are like, oh, you know, I thought you were so smart. You know, I listened to your podcast but this is not cool. It's like I'm looking at it on all levels, you know, you have to just, you have to look past some of the negative, especially when we're talking about, you know, like the neighborhood he was from, the gang over there is Rolling 60s. And that's one of the biggest Crip gangs in Los Angeles and one of the most notorious. So it's like, you know, are we just going to send in a platoon of Marines and, you know, start doing airstrikes? Or is that how we're going to get the Rolling 60s out? Or are you going to connect with the Rolling 60s and from the ground up, you're going to fix it? And that's the same concept you and guys like you are working with overseas. And it's worked to, you know, some success. You know?
No, absolutely. Well, man, I'm glad you addressed it, man. And I got your full support on that, man. You know, in favor of you against those comments that you received, man. You know, it's crazy. We live in a crazy time. We live in a divided time. And what's so sad about the time we live in is, you know, people are not willing to step out of their lane and into another lane and be open to hear what someone else has to say.
Right.
Or be open to listen. You know what I mean? It's either you're on the right side, and I don't mean this, I'm not, no pun intended, I'm not saying this from a political standpoint. It's either you're on the right side and you're going to stay on the right side and you're going to believe what the right side believes and all that, or you're on the left side and you're going to stay on the left side and you're going to believe what the left side is saying and all that. And no one's crossing over and no one's open to hearing what each side has to say.
Right.
And that's why you could have where you do a comment on a post and people flip out on you, because it's like they don't know your heart. They're not even willing to hear your heart. It's just like, I'm right. Everything I say is right. Everything I've done is right. And all of my perspectives are right.
Right, exactly.
So you are absolutely wrong for saying what you said. And there's no truth. There's absolutely no truth in what you said. There's no love in what you said. Everything you said is just absolutely negative. Like, that needs to stop, man. Like, straight up, that needs to stop. We have to be willing to step outside of the box, step outside of our bubble, and at least empathize and be open to hear why you had the thought that you had and why you had the comment that you had versus just shutting it down.
And what's my perspective, right? Because everyone has a different perspective, but you know, just like tying it into like, you know, military and strategy. When early on in the war in Afghanistan, right, they sent small teams of Green Berets into certain areas that are today are really notorious bad places. Actually, I'm forgetting the exact name, but there was a special forces captain. He wrote a book. I completely do not remember the name of it. But basically what he was talking about was that they went into this area, a 12-man ODA, and I think they had like a couple of Marines with them, maybe a scout sniper team for security and a little extra muscle, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, they set up in this village, and, you know, they're doing this unconventional warfare thing, a very small footprint, not a lot of guys, but they're connecting with the people. And that's literally their entire job is to connect with the local population and deny the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and all these foreign fighters the space to operate, because it's if you have the people with you, it'll work, right?
Yeah.
And that mindset of not being able to empathize and not being able to work with the local population, that's where some of the mistakes were made in Afghanistan early on.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they had this entire area like locked up for the most part. Like, there's still direct action stuff going on. They still had to go out on raids and things like that. But half of the fight was just, you know, it's been kind of cliched now after so many years. But, you know, you're talking about the hearts and minds piece of it.
Yeah.
But that's reality, though. Like, if we're not going to go in and just bomb the entire country to dust, then it has to happen through that unconventional method.
Exactly.
You know?
No, I agree 100%. It's like we ain't going back to Japan years.
Yeah, like, you know, we're not nuking.
Dropping the nuclear, nuclear places. So if you're not going to nuke a place, then you have to also understand that 90% of the people that you're 90% of the people that you're surrounded around by are not your enemy.
Right.
So just probably like 10% or 20%, depending on the country or the region you're in.
Right.
And it's going to be that 80-90%. That's going to help you win the battle. Most of the people that I fought that helped me do the job that I did in the country I was in was the locals.
Right.
And it was because I was able to, you know, kind of like I shared early, with through that common ground, build relationship and, you know, actually showed that I cared about them, because that's a whole nother piece to it. Because I did. Every informant that I work with, and I'm just using that term, you know, I don't mean that in a negative way. I cared about them. I cared about their life. I cared about their well-being. I cared about their country. You know, it wasn't like I'm just over here to kick down doors and you know, smash people. That wasn't where my heart was. My heart was to help people. And I think that the people, that the locals that I work with, they were able to recognize that this dude cares for me. And when they recognize that, that's when change begins to happen and perspective begins to change. You know what I mean? And I'm just hoping, man, and in some way we can see that more in this country, man. You know?
We need it.
We need it big time, man. We're focusing on reaching the hearts and minds and being open to hearing and not just being so combative and so, you know what, I'm going to just, and I'd say this proverbially, smash my opponent, you know? It's crazy.
Yeah, and I'm using some of these examples because these are all things that you can look at It's already, the information is out there. It's in the public space. It's not super secret classified. Like, people can do their research on this. And you look at anything. I mean, you look at old World War II spy books and novels, and or, you know, what worked in Vietnam and what didn't work, or what works in Afghanistan, what didn't work. And all of the things that were successful, when you're talking about connecting with people and having to connect with people in order to achieve the mission, all of that is relating to people, putting yourself in their shoes, understanding them. And all those, these are all examples of things that have worked. And one of the, in Afghanistan, once that ODA rotated out, maybe another ODA rotated in, another Special Forces team. And then, like, the next rotation in was, like, an Army Infantry Unit or a Marine Infantry Unit. And and that, once they got in, that's when things changed. And it isn't because those infantry guys are not capable. They're perfectly capable, but their job isn't to do that work with the locals. Like, that's not their job. Their job is direct action.
Front lines.
Right. Like, their job is to go in and kill as many people as they can, you know? And so it's not their fault that it didn't work. It's the higher up's fault. And, you know, a full bird colonel or a general, some, whoever's in charge of that area, is not going to listen to a Special Forces captain. And so just connecting it to, like, to some of those comments that people had on that post about Nipsey Hussle, it's like, if you're that short-sighted, it's just not going to, you're not going to succeed. Like, you can succeed in life. You can, you know.
No, you're going to succeed, but you're going to succeed within your own sphere for the most
part. Right. Because if you plan on branching out, it's not going to happen.
No, because you can't, like that person you said that's, and this is no, I'm not hitting on anybody from any region. I've been all around the country, so please don't take this the wrong way, anybody. But, you know, if you're from, and I'm not even going to use the South as an example, so I can see people, but if you're from Chicago, you know, and everything you do or say is approved or agreed upon by people in Chicago, and that's all you know your entire life, when you go to Los Angeles, you're gonna get punched in the face.
Yeah, it's not gonna work. Yep.
So, you know what I mean? And that's something that I had to learn in the military. Like the military changed my perspective so much, because I grew up in the Bronx. And me growing up in the Bronx, especially in my first command, because all I knew was Bronx, that's how I began to act early on in my Navy career, my first command. And that almost destroyed my career. Because here I am, this is the way I'm used to talking to people, this is the way I'm used to people dealing with me. And I'll share a story. It was this HM3, which is equivalent of a corporal in the Marine Corps. And when I checked into the command, like, you know, I checked into a hospital. So a Navy hospital is different from an infantry unit. Like, to me, when I was working at Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton, it was like I was working at, you know, Sinai Hospital in New York City. You know what I'm saying? Because there's no real military edict. You wear a military uniform, but there's no real, like, nobody's shouting you down. You're not having uniform inspections, and a lot of that doesn't take place. And I remember, you know, checking into the hospital, and the receptionists were civilians. They were super nice to me. So I'm just having a conversation the way, you know, New York do, you know, cool. Hey, I'm happy to be here, this and that. And then my LPO came up, with leading petty officer for the clinic. She came and introduced herself to me, and we're having a conversation, just normal. She's being respectful to me, I'm being respectful to her. It's easy. And then she introduces me to this HM3 that's going to be in charge of me for the next, which turned out to be the next year. And when she introduced me to the HM3, she said, I'm HM3 so-and-so. And I said, hey, I'm at Aleke, you know? And she kind of gave me a mean look, but she didn't say anything because the LPO was right there. And then, you know, the LPO was telling her, hey, you know, show Remy around the clinic and teach him what to do, this and that. And she was like, we'll do. And then the LPO left. And when the LPO left, the HM3 walked up to my face and she said, H-A. And I said, what? She was like, "You are H.A. Adeleke. Don't you dare introduce yourself to me as Adeleke. You are in the military." And she starts flipping. She puts a finger in my face, dude. And she's flipping on me, dude. And I'm like, and literally, I turn my nose up like, who you talking to?
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? And she said, "Stand in attention." I'm like, "No, I ain't standing in attention." And she's, "Oh." And like, as I'm getting ready to get real street on her, the only thing that kept me from going deeper to the dark side, from staying within my bubble, right? Staying within my, because you know how it is in New York. Somebody disrespect you, somebody play you, you're going to do something.
Yeah.
And that's all I knew. And the only thing that kept me from staying within my bubble, staying within what I've been taught and how I've been taught to live, was the petty officer Tiana, who snuck me into the Navy. Because right before I was getting ready to flip out, I thought back to her saying, to her giving me that opportunity. And if I'd have done the wrong thing, then I would have validated the reason why the government said I couldn't join the military.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And so I had to learn early on, I need to step outside of my bubble and be willing to bend in a different direction. Not against, you know, and I don't want to say convictions, but not against, not anything immoral, but just be willing to look at things from a different perspective. Because if I'm not going to be willing to step outside of my bubble and look at life from a different perspective, in that case, a military perspective, she was right to a certain extent. Now, the way she went about correcting me, was that right? We could argue whether it was right or wrong. I would say it was wrong. But I was supposed to use rank. I was supposed to introduce myself as H.A. Adeleke. I was supposed to stand at attention as soon as she told me to stand at attention. I was supposed to not talk back or twist my... because this is the new world that I'm in. And so if I'd have stayed in that old world, I'd have got kicked out of the Navy. Or I'd have end up in jail. Or I'd have end up doing stuff that I wasn't supposed to do. And so I just say all that to say that all of us, we're raising these bubbles. And the bubbles are good because it's where we get our core, you know, some our good core values. It's where we learn how to be comfortable. But at some point, we got to be willing to step out of that bubble and learn how to adapt and take on other lessons. Because if not, we're not going to survive.
Right.
You know, kind of going back to that analogy, Chicago, L.A., if you think you're going to come to L.A. and do everything exactly the way you did everything in Chicago, you ain't going to make it. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does.
So, I just say that about people, man, like with these comments and all that stuff. Yeah, I get comments too, man. I've gotten all kinds of crazy comments, you know, from people who, you know, man, like, you know, because, you know, I'm a Christian, you know, and, you know, people like, man, how could you be a Christian and be a Navy SEAL? Like, you can't do that. That's impossible. Like, that's hypocrisy. That's this, that's that. And you know, I don't argue with them, you know, because it's just like, you know, I'm not going to argue with somebody who's already shown that. Once somebody starts shouting me down, I already realize, I immediately know that there is no me. It doesn't matter what I say. Their opinion is already made.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it doesn't matter. And it's, and that's the thing, like, and a lot of the people or majority of the people who listen to my show are patriotic Americans or people who served in some form or fashion in foreign service. And and the whole, you know, the last episode I did, well, actually, by the time this goes up, this wouldn't be the last episode, but
yeah,
I had to think about that. But I recorded with this guy, and he was the director of overseas operations for the CIA. That's where he finished at.
Yeah.
So his entire 30 plus year career was spent overseas.
Yeah, wow.
Living with other people, you know, talking their language, eating their food, learning their customs, you know, and in a lot of cases, you have to work in places that are dangerous, but the ability to connect with people is what keeps you alive, and I think that's a lesson that people should take home, and there's so many examples of it. Your story is one of them, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I appreciate that. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
So So after you retired from the Navy, what was that like for you? And then can we talk about some of the things you've been doing since then?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can't use the term retired because I didn't do 20 years.
I'm sorry. Just, yeah, that's
yeah. Me, yeah. Yeah. So I separated. And the reason why I got out, you know, I kind of, because people ask me that question all the time, man, you had to do a SEAL and you went through that. And you get, why'd you get out? You know, I had two boys, man, at that time. You know, my oldest was two and my youngest was one. And I just needed to be home. You know, being a SEAL, you're just gone so much between training and operating. And so, yeah, I got out and crazy story. I got out to be home. And 3 months later, you know, of, you know, fidgeting around, you know, trying to figure out my way, figure out what I'm going to do in life. You know, I just kind of. I reverted back to what I knew. And so I applied to GRS. I'm sure you're familiar with that term.
Yeah.
And I was going through the application process. I had my first interview that went good and I turned and everything was already submitted. And then, and me and the recruiter just stopped communicating with me. Like after like, you know, communicating for like 2 weeks or something like that, 2-3 weeks. And then all of a sudden he just stopped communicating with me. And so, you know, I suspected that I didn't make the cut. You know, I suspected that maybe in some way, you know, I didn't qualify. And so I just, you know, continue mission. And I was in grad school at the time, getting my master's in organizational strategy. I went to the University of Charleston, West Virginia. Great school, by the way. I want to give them a shout out. I was sitting at my computer writing papers for school, and I get a phone call from this woman. I won't mention her name, but she's worked with Michael Bay since The Rock in 96, her and her husband. And she was like, "Hey, Michael Bay's looking for an African-American SEAL to do a little role in a movie." Name of the movie's Transformers. And I was like, "Yeah, I mean, Michael Bay. I mean, that's the dude that inspired me to be a SEAL. Yeah, I'll do that. You know what I mean?" And so she said, "Hey, send me some pictures." And I didn't have headshots because I wasn't in Hollywood. I wasn't thinking about being in Hollywood. So, you know, I just sent her random military pictures because she was like, "Just send me pictures of you in uniform and, you know, downrange and stuff." So I sent her a few and she called me back like 2 hours later. She's like, "Hey, Michael Bay likes your look. He wants you on set tomorrow." Yeah. And so I was like, "Cool." So I went to set, and this is all in SoCal, LA area. And it was cool, man. It was crazy because I remember the set was in the desert, like in the middle of nowhere. It was like this flat desert. It was crazy, and I got there early because I show up to something new like that, you want to make sure you're not late. So I got there early. When I got there, it was like, it's like one truck, and the truck had some of the Transformer cars in it, like the Bumblebee car was in there, and I was like, "Man, this is cool," but it was nobody. And then like an hour later, the entire set was jam-packed with like lighting people, props people, costume department, trailers, bathrooms, catering. Like it was just like crazy. And you know, we shouldn't. And I went and I put on my costume, and then I picked out sunglasses, and then Michael Bay came up to me, and you know, and he's like, you know, having me try on different sunglasses. I was like, "Man, this is so crazy right now." Yeah. But yeah, man, I shot that day, and it was just supposed to be one day. And you know, like about 2 weeks later, the lady calls me back. She's like, "Hey, Michael Bay likes your look. He likes the way you take direction. Can you come back for 2 more weeks?" A week in Arizona and a week in Michigan. And I was like, "Sure." So I went back. Actually, it was 3 more weeks. So I did a week in Arizona, and then I had some work I had to do in Israel. So I flew out to Israel. Did some work out there for something else outside of the film stuff. And then I flew back from Israel. We were in Michigan and filmed in Michigan for 2 weeks. And then after those 2 weeks, one of the production assistants approached me and was like, "Hey, Michael Bay wants to keep you on as cast. Would you like to stay on until we wrap filming?" And I was like, "Sure." So I stayed on film until we wrapped in July. And that's kind of how I got into the film and TV industry. And once you do a movie like that, it just opens up doors. Like it's just one of those things where you don't really have to really, you know, audition. And I mean, you still got to do that, but you don't have to really chase it, you know, doors open. So it was through that that I was able to get an Army commercial, and then I got a national AT&T commercial, and then I signed an endorsement deal with Jockey Underwear. And all my boys in the teams, they made fun of me. It's a saying in the team, seals, we don't wear underwears because we don't. But I was like, hey, when Jockey came up to me, they threw a check at me. I was like, yeah, I want that in my drawers. So, yeah, man, I signed an endorsement deal with them and did a commercial with them in my underwear. You can go watch it on YouTube and everywhere where commercials like that play. And then, you know, I did a print campaign with them. And then, you know, that led to my book deal, man. I got my book deal with HarperCollins, and which is one of the big three publishers in the world. And and that's where, you know, my mindset began to shift from actor to writer. Because you got to remember, you know, everything that I've done since I've been out wasn't something that I was, well, I won't say everything, but the majority of what I've done since I've been out hasn't been something that I pursued. Speaking has been probably the only thing that I've really pursued, because, you know, I like to inspire people and motivate people and speak truth. But acting I didn't pursue, and writing I didn't pursue. But now those are my primary sources of revenue now. So I got into when I signed my deal with HarperCollins. Originally, my mom was signed on as a writer, but after 2 months of her writing, I read three chapters that she wrote, and I was just like, this is not me. It's not my voice. It's not my story. It's her story. And I had done a lot of writing in my life because, as an Intel human guy, I had to write reports. You know, I had to write tons of reports, especially downrange. Every time I had a meeting with an informant, or every time I went somewhere, you know, I had to write these long, detailed reports. You know, what was the informant wearing? Like, what was his mood? Like, what did he say? Where did he say this guy? Like, long, detailed reports. And those reports would be sent up to generals and different agencies, and they would read it. So grammatically, everything had to be spot on. So after I kind of, you know, told my mom I was going to take the reins, that's when I kind of put all of those lessons I learned as a detailed writer into writing my book. And I wrote my book, and there's more to that story, but that's what led me into writing films. So I wrote my first film after I finished my book, called The Chameleon. And that book now that screenplay has been read by some major people in the industry, and it's gotten nothing but like straight A's as far as like a screenplay, especially a first screenplay. And so now, you know, I just finished my last rewrite last night, and we're getting ready to take it to market. So I'm signed with Zero Gravity. They produce Ozark on Netflix. They produced The Accountant, nice, with Ben Affleck. They produced it's a new Netflix show that they're producing with LeBron James and Octavia Spencer about Madam C.J. Walker, Proud Mary. They produce a bunch of big stuff. So they signed me as a writer. So I wrote my first film. And we're getting ready to take that to market. We've already had like a major production company offer to co-finance the film, which is huge, because the number one way a film gets made is through financing. And I have a company already want to put up a large, when I say large, I mean millions and millions of dollars for the film to go into production. That's a huge step. So it's a great sign. So I got that going. I'm writing my second film now, which I can't go into great detail about it, but it's about the first group of one of the first group of African Americans to serve as special operations. It's a fascinating story. It's [S2] Wow. [S1] A story that hasn't been told, and that should be told. And I came across the story, and I was just like, this is my next movie. So I'm about a third of the way through the movie, and it is fascinating. I mean, just the stuff that these guys went through, and the heroic feats that they've accomplished, and how no one knows about it. You know, wow, these guys were legit special forces guys, African Americans, getting after it, you know, kicking down doors and taking names and doing stuff. And because um, because of segregation of the military, you know, they were pretty much an all African American, you know, unit. So I'm writing that film now. I'm hoping to have it done before my book releases, and then we're looking to take that to market. And then I'm probably going to write the screenplay for my film, screenplay for my book, because a lot of people, actually, before I finished writing my book, I was approached by major studios and major people who I mentioned their names. I can't mention their names on this podcast, but if I mention their names, a lot of people would know who they are, or the projects that they've created. But before I finished writing the book, people were approaching me and asking me for the rights to the book, to turn the book into a film. So that's something that we know is going to happen. And so I'm trying to stay ahead. So after I finish this project I'm writing now, the next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to start writing my book. I'm going to adapt the book into a screenplay.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, man.
That's awesome. Yeah, so, yeah, that's good stuff, man.
Thank you. So that's pretty much my day-to-day operations right now. And then, you know, I kind of touched on it earlier, but my nonprofit work, man, that's what really drives me. It's what fuels me. Everything that I do, it helps me financially so that I could do this without worrying about money. So that I could do my, you know, work with my kids. And when I say kids, I don't mean my personal kids. I mean my kids and City of Hope, excuse me. And, you know, just pour into them and try to, you know, change the trajectory of their life. Because one thing I learned is sometimes it just takes one person like me, like my recruiter. It just took her one act. She wasn't even in my life for more than 2 weeks. It just took one act to change the trajectory of my life. So, yep. You know, I'm blessed with the opportunity to be to spend more than 2 weeks with my kids. You know, I got three special ones that are, you know, under my thumb right now that, you know, I'm hoping that I want to see them be somebody because they have so much potential. And none of all three of them, their dads are not in their lives. Dads haven't been in their lives and their dads are not dead. Their dads are very well alive. They're just not in their lives. And so I'm like dads to these kids, man. And so that's the big thing I do now is to try and, you know, be that instrument of change and you know, watch these kids grow to be men.
Yeah, it's such important work. And, you know, looking at it, like there's so many perspectives it can be looked at from. And I've heard from the perspective of someone who is trying to affect change, like even if you look at it from so many different levels, like we want to change this area, we want to change these kids,
yeah,
we want to break this cycle and take the negatives out of the culture.
Yeah.
But then if you look at it, and that's one perspective, but then look at it from another perspective, look at it from the national perspective, how much talent are we losing in some of these inner cities? You know, there's so many, you know, the next analyst at the NSA or the, you know, just anything.
I agree.
There's so much talent in some of
the agree, man.
And it gets lost in the sauce, man. And I think it's time that we really reached in and try to change the culture.
No, I agree 100%, man. And that's actually, it's funny you bring that up because that's one of the things I said to my kids on Tuesday. Like, you guys have so much potential. Like, you don't even know it right now. You know, and so there are so many kids in the inner city.
Yeah.
They're just so talented. You know what I mean? Naturally talented and gifted. You know, and if they apply themselves
to
positive things, it changes everything. Because they do apply themselves, but they apply themselves. I mean, I'm just speaking for some of the kids I work with. You know, they apply themselves to the wrong things.
Yep.
You know, but if they apply themselves to the right things, and it's crazy because, you know, I was with my kids, the kids the other day, and, you know, I just felt like this old man. Because, you know, as a kid, you know, the last thing I wanted to hear about is do good in school, kid.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly,
I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, yo, guys, listen, I said, you guys are in middle school, getting ready to go to middle school. This is a turning point in your life. like, let's get after it. Let's focus on these grades, this math, this science. Let's get this down. Like, and I'm all about, hey, whatever you do, do it with excellence. That's another thing I try to preach to these kids. Whatever you do, do with excellence. Don't just meet the standard. Like, I hate people who just meet the standard, who just check the box. Like, no, anytime you do anything, you are to blow past the standard. You are to do it you have to do it with excellence. And so I'm preaching this to the kids the other day, and I like midstream, I'm like, man, I know that these kids are like, dude, you're talking to me about school. Like, last thing I think about school, because it's hard, I think, for kids to put two and two together to see, you know, okay, if I do good in school, this is going to lead to me, you know, doing good in high school. If I do good in high school, this is going to lead to me getting into college. If I do good in college, it's going to lead to me getting a good job. If I do good in jobs, this is going to lead to me making money. If I make good money, it's going to lead to me being able to provide for my family. And so it's hard for young people to see how where you are now and what you do now could affect your future. You know, so I just felt like this old freaking nerd, you know what I mean?
But that's how it is, though. And it's like, I remember as a kid, you know, they'll tell you things like, you know, you can be whatever you want. You know, you can be the president of the United States someday. And it's like, I mean, and some kids get it early on and they do the right thing and they, you know, they do what they're supposed to do. But some people, it just doesn't click right away. And I remember like hearing these things and it's like, okay, yeah, whatever, sure. You know, I want to get back to my conversation, you know, whatever it is I'm doing. But then you hit a point in life where you're like, you know, I really could do anything that I want to.
And
but it sounds the same as what you heard as a kid and you just brushed it off.
Absolutely.
But it's understanding that that is the truth and what that means makes all the difference, you know?
No, absolutely. We are our only limits. That's one of my sayings. Like, I say to myself, and that's one of the things I try to like preach to my kids, like, you know, and you know, my biological kids as well, is like, you are your only limit. You know what I mean? Like, especially like, I've been to other parts of the world. Like, I went back to Nigeria last year to finish writing my book, because I wanted to make sure that the spirit of the ending of my book was where it needed to be. And I needed to be in Nigeria. I needed to experience the culture. I needed to be around my people again. And, you know, when you go to Nigeria, you just see how, wow, man, it's just so hard to make it, man. Unless you born into extreme wealth, because the disparity between the rich and the poor is just so large. It's just a massive, massive wealth gap. And if you're poor, like, it's hard for you to rise out of that, man. Yeah. It's like so hard, because even, you know, it's almost like and it's not a caste system, but it's almost like you're stuck in this caste system because the way the government structure is, you know what I mean? And when I come back to the States and I see like all the opportunities.
Yeah, it's endless.
The opportunities are endless, man. Like, endless. Like, and that's why, you know, immigrants, like especially African, especially Nigerian immigrants, they come over here and they crush it.
Yeah.
Because they've come from a world where no matter how hard they worked, they were still going to be in the same place.
Right.
Not because it's their fault, but because of the way the government is structured. And then they come over here and they see how, wait, what I put out is what I get back?
Right, and they kill it. Yeah,
they kill it. Like, real talk. I'm gonna be real. You know what I'm saying? My dad. He's my dad. He made some decisions that I didn't find out about until I was in my 20s. You know, like decades after he died. And what I mean by that is, my dad had kids. He cheated on my mom, and he had kids, and me and my mom, nobody knew. For decades. Like, I have a sister that grew up in Queens.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? She's 2 years younger than me. Now, my dad, he was born in Nigeria. My grandfather, my father's father, he had 7-8 wives.
Mm.
Wives. Like, not like concubine, not like, no, 8 wives that lived with him.
Wow.
Because that's the culture.
Right.
Especially when my grandfather, especially at that time, even to this day, right? In certain parts of Nigeria. So my dad was the firstborn son to my grandfather, right? And then my grandfather died when my dad was 8. But still, he was raised in this culture where it's okay to have multiple women. It's okay to have, you know, but even though he was raised in that culture, he was educated in the West, because he got a full ride scholarship to study engineering in London. And then after he studied, and then he got his master's in engineering, he got his master's in architecture. He was one of the first black men on the board of the World Trade Center in New York. He was one of the first black men on the towning the planning council in Great Britain. So he had his European culture, which said, you know, get married. But then he also, his European culture was, his Western culture, excuse me, was in conflict with his Nigerian tribal culture. And so that's why, you know, I can't really be mad at him. Like there were times after I found out, like I was mad at him, like, dude, how could you do that to my mom? But, you know, being a man now, like I understand that, you know, he was at war within himself. And so, but anyway, I say all that to say, and I'm sorry for giving you a long about story, but my dad had a lot of kids. And literally, I've met siblings. I meet new siblings that are my actual blood, half blood. You know, I've done blood tests where they are my confirmed siblings who, wow, you know, who grew up in Africa. You know what I'm saying? And they immigrated to the United States. I got a sister, half sister, that's an illegal immigrant in New Jersey right now. Okay. I ain't gonna say her name because her name is different than me and she married and all that. But, you know, my half brother, that dude came over here. My half sister was the most recent one to come over here. I still have another half sister who lives in Ghana now, who's a year younger than me. My half brother, he immigrated over here, I want to say like 8-9 years ago. And when he immigrated over here, he was like, I'm going to be a doctor. And so that dude, he became a cab driver. He's a cab driver in Chicago. He became a cab driver in Chicago, grinding, right? Because he's like, hey, I'm in the United States. I'm going to be a doctor. Like literally, he's about to start med school. But you know how long it took for him to be able to get to med school? It took him years and years and years of, you know, applying for his citizenship, working that cab, getting robbed. That dude showed me a video because in the cabs they had in Chicago, they had the cameras, and the dude put a gun to his head, getting ready to blow his brains out over a few dollars. You know what I'm saying? Getting robbed, but still showing up to the job, grinding every day, working through the night, doing all of that, going to school in the daytime, getting his bachelor's degree, still driving cabs. And then he got accepted into this pre-med program. That was like super far away from his house. So he would drive all the way to this area, like 6 hours, go to school, drive back, be with his wife and his kid. And dude's about to go to med school. But the reason why he's like that is because he comes from a place. He grew up in Nigeria.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So he comes from this place where it don't matter how hard, if he did all of the stuff that he did in America over there, he would be in the negative.
Yeah, it just wouldn't work. You know what
I'm saying? Yep. It wouldn't work. But him being here, he came over here, he saw all these opportunities. He's like, yo, sky's the limit.
Yeah.
And, you know what I'm saying?
And people take it for granted. And that's it. You know, I'm glad you spoke about that. Some of my good friends, one of my friends, he's from the Bronx, but his family is from Ghana. And, yeah. And his parents immigrated here. So he's like first generation American. And but his parents, they were just hustlers, you know, and they barely spoke English, but you know, and that's the same story. And, you know, some of my other friends, they immigrated from Albania, and it's the same thing with their parents. You know, they grew up in the Bronx, and, you know, their parents worked really hard, and now, you know, they own property and they're all doing all right. And it's just like, you see that so much, especially in New York, because, you know, it's one of the most diverse cities in the world.
Yeah, and, exactly.
You just see so many examples of that.
Yeah.
And even, you know, one of my friends, he was born here, but his parents, they were born in Albania. And he's now a teacher. You know, he got his master's degree. He's a teacher now. And in one of his courses for his master's, the teacher was from, I don't remember where he was from, but he wasn't from the U.S.,
Yeah.
Very smart guy. He spent, you know, over 20 years in the U.S. or whatever. And he told them in a lot of cases, the immigrant students outperform American students.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
It's not because they have some special gift. I mean, some people are gifted, but they just work harder, you know. And it's,
yeah, they work harder.
Yeah.
And then I think a lot of it is a parenting too, right? Like, and that's one thing, you know, I talk about, you know, in my book, you know, like my mom, like she was a teacher in the South Bronx. So she knew how bad the public education system was firsthand. You know what I mean? And so, like, on the weekends, she would make my brother and I read the New York Times and write reports. You know what I'm saying? Because she was like, you guys are not going to be a statistic. You guys are going to graduate. Like, the statistics are horrible. Like, when I was doing research like a year ago for my book, I think it was like, it's a ridiculous number. It's like only, and like, you don't quote me on this, but it's something like only 20% of people from the Bronx go to college.
Yeah.
Like, it was a ridiculous statistic, something like that. Like, don't quote me on it firmly. But my mom was like, you guys are not going to be that part of that statistic. And so she would do the work that the schools weren't doing. And it's on a lot of the parents to say, you know what? I know the school system is not good. And I know, but I have to keep my kid in the school because our house is right down the street and I can't afford to drive them across town. But I'm going to give them extra writing assignments. I'm going to do their homework with them. I'm going to make sure their math and science and all these things are on par. I'm going to do the research. If I have forgotten how to do calculus or trigonometry, I'm going to do the research myself to get up to speed. So when I check my kid's assignment, I can make sure that it's on par and it's meeting the standard or passing the standard. And that's what it is with immigrant parents. And I'm speaking for, because I know, you know, growing up as a Nigerian American, every time a Nigerian in the Bronx or in school or whoever, every time they heard my last name, Adeleke, they know you Yoruba, you are Yoruba, because Yoruba is a tribe.
Right.
So they recognize the name as a Yoruba Nigerian tribe. And so because of that, I built all of these relationships with a lot of African, specifically Nigerian immigrants, or people who parents were immigrated over and then they had kids.
Right.
All of them across the board, their parents were involved in their education.
Yeah.
And these were kids who went to the same public schools I went to, but their parents was like, listen, I'm not having it. If you don't come home with an A, I'm going to tear you up.
Yeah, exactly.
You will not come home with the A. You will not come with the A. I'm chopping you up. That's the way it is. You know what I'm saying? And so my mom, knowing how my dad was when he died, my mom was just like, yo, it's an A or nothing less. You know? And so a lot of it falls on the parents, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's tough, man. It's tough. I've seen some pretty bad situations just growing up, or, you know, kids you go to school with and things like that. But yeah, it's just, it's funny as you're talking, like, I just keep thinking about my friend who's from Ghana, and and some of the jokes we make about immigrant parents and, you know, and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah. But it pays off in the long run, right?
It does.
Like, it's not like, you know, it's not pleasant because your friends are making fun of you. You know what I mean? Like, you know, especially when you can't come outside to play and they make fun of you and all that other stuff. But now, fast forward 20 years later, who's laughing?
Exactly. Right. And he, you know, he's from the South Bronx, immigrant parents, you know, has a master's degree. He's a teacher. Yeah. And, yeah, he's doing all right. You know, he's raising his kid, and, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how it is, yeah.
And I think another thing, too, with immigrant parents, and I find looking back to my dad, you know, immigrant parents, and obviously we're not speaking generally, like every immigrant parent, but a lot of immigrant parents, they're forward-leaning. What I mean by that is they're looking generations. They think generational, right? So they don't think like, oh, my kid needs to get, like, I need to make sure my kid is successful. They think like, I want to make sure my grandkid has what they need. Like, so the reason why they want you to be right and you to be successful and you to be this is because they're thinking about their legacy. Right. So they're thinking about that grandchild. They're thinking about that great, great grandchild. And a lot of immigrant parents look like they're thinking way into the future, where I think a lot of, you know, more American parents, and I could be wrong on this, they just think about kind of the here and now, like my child right here. You know, let me make sure that, you know, you get school closed, this and that. But not past that, you know. And I could be wrong, but so don't quote me on that.
Yeah. Yeah, now there's going to be a bunch of people like, hey, wait a minute, that's not, you know, my parents were like that.
Well, you can cut it out there, cut it out there.
That's all right, that's all right. Yeah, that's cool, man. And, you know, I'm glad I got to talk to you. Knowing a little bit of your story before we really spoke, I knew that there were things we could probably connect on that, you know, most of the guests I have on, I can't connect with on certain levels.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was really great talking to you, man. And
same here.
And, you know, like I said, I'm glad I got to go to talk to you. But so if people want to keep up with you on social media, they want to pay attention and follow you and be on the lookout for some of your film stuff, where's the best place they can do that at?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you right now. But before I tell you guys, first off, I just want to, before I forget, I want to tell you, man, if that nonprofit you mentioned ever needs help, or anything in the South Bronx, like, hey, we need a special forces former guy to come out here to do a talk or to just do a mentorship session with some kids, like, hit me up.
Great. I will.
You know, I'm in New York this week, and I'm saying that this week, like, this podcast dropped this week, but I'm in New York this week. So, you know, if something is thrown together, you know, let me know and I'll make it happen to come inspire some kids and, you know, show them, you know, allow them to look in the mirror, see me in themselves and see their potential that they could be me or greater than me, you know. But yeah, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. It's all the same. Remy, R-E-M-I, Adeleke, A-D-E-L-E-K-E. Again, that's Remy Adeleke on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. And then my book is everywhere now. You can go to Barnes & Nobles, BAM, Amazon, wherever books are sold, you can find Transformed. That's the title of my book. The subtitle is a Navy SEAL's Unlikely Journey from the Throne of Africa to the Streets of the Bronx, Defying All Odds. Go pick it up. You won't regret it. You will learn some cool things, not about me, but about yourself. I guarantee you there will be chapters in the book where you will see yourself in the stories, but you'll also see that despite the odds that you're facing, you have the ability to overcome them.